Okay. Now we're okay. All right, got it. Technology is all in place. Just to keep you oriented, at the beginning and at the end of class, the clock is 4 minutes past. Okay. It is right now 27 minutes after. Therefore, okay, at the other end of class, 2:43. We am. Trust me. We synchronized our watches. We're okay. Assignment 4, if you haven't picked it up, is here. Assignment 5, Julie and Greg are having a great deal of fun reading. They're discovering why it takes me so long to get papers back. Okay. There's one way to get sympathy around here, which is ask somebody else to walk in your shoes. But they're doing a wonderful job guarding them. On the screen, two things coming up, one tomorrow night, one Wednesday night, both on families, and I try to pick out some of the better things going on campus. Some of you have family members or know people who have family members who are mentally ill, or people themselves who are mentally ill, and there are students on campus who have psychiatric illnesses of one sort or another, and four people who are themselves mentally ill or who have family members who are mentally ill, will be talking in Lafayette at 7, a panel presentation on dealing with mental illness while a college student, either your own or a family member's. It'll be a very interesting program. And if you're in psych, sociology, social work, human development, and family studies, or any related field, or have personal experience, I recommend that one. The other one is Wednesday evening, and that is a film in Ira Allen at 7. The film is Searching for Angela Shelton. She is, as far as I know, not related to me. I'm not shilling for my family. We probably are, but I'll discuss that with her if I meet her. Angela Shelton is a journalist and filmmaker, and the film grew out of a project that, like some of your term papers, you know, you start off in one direction and you end up in another direction. She thought it would be interesting to do a documentary in which she interviewed people who had the same name. So she set off cross-country in an RV with a camera crew to interview people named Angela Shelton. And she found 40 of them and interviewed most of them. We all think we're unique, right? And how many of you know approximately how many people in the United States have the same name you have? It's really fascinating. You do one of those people searches. I found out that there are 27 Lawrence Sheltons, not in the country. There are 27 who have frequent flyer accounts with American Airlines. That's how many they looked through to retrieve my number one day when I couldn't find it. And what they did, very interesting, illegal too, they pulled them all up and just asked me a series of questions about where I lived until they matched the address and then got my number. But the person who was doing it was looking at 27 accounts for people named Lawrence Shelton. That's scary. Angela Shelton started doing the interviews, and along the way, discovered that a fair number of those women who shared her name shared her experience of having been sexually assaulted, and more than half of them. So she made a film not just about interviewing people with the same name, but about their experience with sexual assault, incest, rape, sexual assault within the family, sexual abuse of one sort or another. The film is not as dreadfully dark and depressing as that topic might seem, but it is very thought-provoking. It's presented as part of April's Sexual Assault Awareness Month on campus. So I recommend that one. I'll see you there, but I will not take attendance. Other housekeeping things? Questions? The retake for the eco exam here after class. How many of you are going to stay for that? I didn't ask that question. Forget it. Okay. How many of you are not staying for that? Okay. How many of you are not staying for the retake class? You understand why I withdrew the question. Okay, we were... We had gotten married, if you remember. And I was talking about Judith Wallerstein's description from her study of the good marriage, of what it is that people have to wrestle with in the weeks and months and first year or so after marriage. And I had suggested that you think about these from a developmental perspective and think about what they mean about the ecology of the couple, separating psychologically as well as physically from family of origin for both people and creating a new way of being connected with the families of origin and other family members, building that marital identity. And I had talked about Murray Bowen's notion of the conflict between togetherness and separateness. And the fact that when you are in a couple relationship, you have two people who are trying to figure out how much time to be together and how to be separate, how much time they need, and they may not have overlapping or very greatly overlapping comfort zones for togetherness and separateness. I think I was saved by the end of the class from talking about establishing the sexual life of the couple, so we'll go on to number... No, we want to talk about sex, don't we? Of course we do. Sex is easy, sex is fun, and on honeymoons you get to practice that. For most couples, it's the first time. The wedding night is traditionally the first time people have had any sexual experience at all. And we'll just leave that illusion alone. Virginity is possible, I'm told, and some of us, in fact, used to do it, although it's fairly rare now at this point. But many couples, believe it or not, really do wait until they are engaged, and some couples still, even now in 2005, happily and comfortably wait until they are married. It's a minority, and I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands if you are in that minority. But if you are, you don't have to be embarrassed about that. And you don't have to feel like there's something abnormal about you. Although I understand that many people do feel that if they get to 20 and have not yet taken the plunge, some people feel that there's something wrong with them. And people say, well, what are you waiting for? What? Maybe you're waiting for it to be really, really good with somebody you really, really, really want it to be with. Nevertheless, even if people are experienced, the sexuality within the marriage, as Wallerstein is suggesting, still has to be negotiated, and the couple still has to create a schedule, a routine, an organization to their 24/7 life together that includes sexual satisfaction and ideally improves on it. And that may require considerable negotiation. Some couples don't talk about sexuality before they're married. Some couples don't talk about it very well after they're married. And it continues to be one of the two or three most important sources of conflict, not only at the beginning of marriage, but throughout marriage. And all you have to do is read Dear Annie to discover that it continues to be a problem for couples all the way through marriage. What features of a relationship in Bronfenbrenner's framework would make it more likely that the sexual life of the couple would be sorted out and satisfying early on? What should the affect be? You don't know, huh? Affect can be from very negative to very positive. Where should your sexual affect be? Positive, right. It should be fun. It should be lots of fun. You should anticipate it. I'm saying should, my personal advice. If you're not anticipating it with great pleasure, if you're not thinking about it, if you're not enjoying it, if it isn't fun, you really do need to negotiate with your partner and make it fun. Sex should never be unpleasant. Sex should never lead to negative affect. It will occasionally in some situations, but that should be cause for negotiation and better communication about it. If you don't know how to do that, take HDFS 65. Too late this semester, but it's offered in the summer. It'll be offered next spring, Human Relationships and Sexuality. You get through that course, you will know how to talk about and negotiate about sexuality and how to make it fun, too. Affect. Reciprocity? A little bit or a lot of reciprocity? A lot of reciprocity. How does reciprocity get manifested in a sexual relationship? If there's give and take, and if there's a lot of reciprocity, it means that each person can initiate, each person can be in charge, each person can direct the activity, and that they can take turns doing that. When couples are able to be highly reciprocal, to please, to receive, to give pleasure, to accept pleasure, to initiate activity, to experiment, to call a halt, when all of those reciprocities are present, then sex is much more likely to be fun. Affect, reciprocity, power. Who should have the power in a sexual relationship? Equal, balance of power. When the power is balanced in a relationship, then neither party needs to be afraid, neither party needs to be anxious, neither party needs to be threatened or to feel threatened by what the other person might think. And if you combine that with positive affect and a high degree of reciprocity, then sex is anxiety-free, fear-free, and pleasure-full. Now we can go on to four, right? And that's part of the same thing. It's related. It's not part of the same thing. It's related. Number four, the marriage is to be established as a zone of safety and nurturance. The partner is the one, the spouse is the one to whom you should be able to come home and not fear what's going to happen there. Not be afraid to bring your tired, frustrated or happy, excited self home to share yourself with the other person. Neither person should feel threatened in the relationship. Ideally, the couple relationship makes the marriage a place where people are renewed, invigorated, validated. Now, all of those consequences of having positive affect and a high degree of reciprocity, and treating each other as if you actually do enjoy and treasure the relationship. Expanding the relationship to make psychological room for children. That doesn't mean to imply that all couples should have children, but it is part of the complication of putting a marriage together. Making the decision how you feel about children and whether or not to have children should be part of the courtship process. That should be something that is discussed, talked about, it's clear, agreed upon before you decide to put the other person in the position of having to change your mind about whether or not and when to have children. It's a constant topic of conversation, and ideally couples agree on it and have similar views of whether, when, how many, and how to have children, and also when to stop having children, though that often gets renegotiated after a couple show up and people decide, okay, six is probably not terribly realistic anymore. It was fine thinking about having our very own hockey team, but maybe we'll have to find some neighbor children to play with ours because we can't possibly deal with six. We're going to talk about the second half of that, safeguarding the private sphere of the couple, in a few minutes. I just wanted to alert you to the importance of figuring out whether or not you're willing to think about having children somewhere along the line with a partner, and making sure that that's a topic of discussion. Also, it's very important to be aware that many people change their minds. And that means it's probably not a good idea to trust the other person completely if he or she says he doesn't or she doesn't or does want children. Life circumstances change. People change their minds. They watch their friends having children. They decide, there is no way I can do that. Or they watch their friends having children and all the good things, the wonderful things that come along with having children, and they decide that they want to change their mind. It is particularly important that many people change their minds from the view they had when they got married in their early 20s. There is no way we want to bring children into this messed up world. It's not fair to children. It's a terrible thing. We don't want to contribute to the overpopulation of the world. Whatever the rationales that people use, or I would be a terrible parent. If that is the position that people take in their early 20s, it's important to know that a fairly large percentage, and I don't know what it is now, but it used to hover around third to a half of people who went into marriage thinking they did not want to have children and agreeing they did not want to have children. In a third to a half of couples who had entered marriage with that intention, their minds got changed along the way. Sometimes to the detriment of the marriage. I'll only give you two quick examples. I'll give you three. One is a good friend of mine who did not want to have children, got married just after she graduated from UVM, and married a man who agreed that they did not want to have children. And his siblings began to have children. Her siblings began to have children. They began to hang out with children. And he began to decide as he hit close to 30 that he wanted to have children. So there got to be some tension in the marriage because he began to ask her to change her mind as she got up to 27 or 28, and she was not willing to change her mind. The tension in the relationship and the conflict over having children eventually led her to, in the context of having almost an affair, but being really tempted by somebody else, it precipitated a divorce that she initiated. And then she got remarried. And at 36, decided she had changed her mind and wanted to have children, and proceeded to have three children. And that was great. It was wonderful. The sad thing is that he who wanted the children never had any. He didn't marry until he was married again until he was 45 or so, and married a woman who couldn't have children, so they didn't. Second experience. I consulted some of you know I do consultation with divorcing couples. And I had a call a while back from a gentleman who wanted to know what his rights were. And I don't advise on rights because I'm not an attorney, but we had actually three conversations eventually about being the parent of a child one didn't want, one never wanted, and that was conceived in one's mid-50s in a relationship in which it had been clear from the very, very beginning that children were never wanted as part of this relationship. And she got pregnant anyway after telling him that she was using birth control. So they didn't get. They weren't married. They'd been together for, 15 years or so. And on the basis of the pregnancy, he ended the relationship because she wouldn't terminate the pregnancy. And so she got really, really angry about that because she had thought that he would change his mind when she got pregnant. And so at the time I saw him, he was trying to make some arrangements to be a fiscally, financially responsible parent, but to have nothing to do with the child as it was growing up. And he wanted to know whether or not he could really protect himself from being contacted by a child for the rest of his life. I don't think he can, but... And then when I saw him about 6 months later, he changed his mind about whether he wanted to be involved with the child. I was thinking that maybe he should give it a try, but by that time she was not speaking to him and wouldn't return his phone calls and was returning his letters unopened. So I didn't talk to him after the child was born, so I don't know what happened. I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. But it was a major bone of contention. And about 10 years ago, I had a similar experience, but the couple was married, and it was a couple who had agreed when they married. At the time they married, he was 50 and she was 30, and she agreed, a second marriage for him, she agreed that she did not want to have children, that was okay, wasn't important to her. He insisted he absolutely did not want children. And at 36, she decided she did want to have children. And she also got pregnant. There's a lesson here that I'll tell you in a minute. You probably already know it. She got pregnant at 36, and he was very upset and disappointed, hung in until the child was one, and then divorced, and I helped them work out a co-parenting agreement. The sense of betrayal that he had was very, very deep, and that she had agreed no children, and this was not supposed to happen. And for her, the sense of betrayal that he didn't understand that she was a woman, and women are supposed to have children. So they were pretty much at each other's throats by the time I saw them, and probably stayed that way, and probably still are. I don't know. I don't do follow-up on most couples. Lessons. A, probably never trust a woman who says she doesn't want to have children unless she's postmenopausal. Then she'll perhaps be interested in the option. Second, never leave the decision about birth control up to the other person if you're really, really serious about not having children. And in both cases, and a couple of others who I've known, men whose partners became pregnant, in all of those I have raised the issue, after it's too late of course, of if you really, really were serious in your 40s about not having children, if this was a decision that you were absolutely certain you would never change, why the heck didn't you get a vasectomy? Why did you leave this up to your partner? And in all four cases, they didn't have an answer. Guys, this is for you. And all of you, raising sons or with brothers or with partners, if a person is really, really convinced, then he or she needs to take the responsibility rather than leaving it up to the partner. Okay, we'll go back to safeguarding the private sphere of the couple. Establishing a relationship that's fun and interesting. How do you do that? Well, you buy lots of books about 750 ways to amuse your partner, 250 ways to say I love you. You decide to keep taking courses, keep reading, keep talking about things, do things together, and whenever you see the partner beginning to become an old fart or stick in the mud, you shake them up some way that's fun. All of your parents know how to do that, okay? Right? So just talk to them. Ask them how they keep their relationship fun and interesting for so long. And since that is one of Wallerstein's tasks that she identified, couples clearly have difficulty figuring out how to do that. One of the reasons they have difficulty is that they weren't having fun and in an interesting relationship before they got married. So one of the implications of that is if you're not having fun and the relationship isn't interesting, if the other person isn't incredibly fascinating and piquing your curiosity and surprising you regularly, you might want to think about why you would want to spend the rest of your life with such a person. There's a wonderful film about lifespan development that's very dated now, but in it there's a wonderful interview with a couple who had been married at that time for about 50 years, and they're both deceased now because the film is fairly old. But the man in the couple is a man named Hubble. As in Hubble Telescope. He is, in fact, the man who designed the Hubble telescope. He's a professor at Princeton. And in the interview, his wife of 50 years, in talking about their relationship, says that, "I think what I treasure most about these 50 years is that I married a man who never ceases to surprise me. He's always doing something new. And that keeps the relationship fun." And he says some nice things about her as well, keeping it interesting. It doesn't happen automatically. It happens because people themselves continue to grow, to learn, to do new things. So they have mesosystems in which they participate that allow them to bring something back into the relationship that keeps it fresh and alive. They have reciprocal interaction and molar activities that they engage in jointly that are fun and interesting for both of them. So having a relationship over a long term that's fun and interesting requires that you continue to develop as individuals and as a couple. And that you have a view of the world. You're recognizing all the quotes from Bronfenbrenner. You have a view of the world that is highly differentiated and valid, so that you recognize that the marriage itself requires regular work and invigoration. And you can't do that by working all the time. You can't do that by never spending time together. You can't do that unless you, in fact, are interested in the other person and willing to spend energy and time being interesting for the other person. Now, if we've talked about valid and differentiated views, the last one, maintaining an idealized view incorporating reality. So, you want to have an idealized view. Your partner should be the most attractive, interesting, intelligent, wonderful person in the entire world. Right? Otherwise, why would you want to marry her, him, them, each other? Okay. So there's a fantasy that we all develop in the process of creating a relationship. And then reality begins to creep in as we have more experience with each other. And the task, Wallerstein says, is to be able to continue to think really wonderful things about your partner even while recognizing the reality that he or she brings and the reality of daily life and the fact that you're going to spend the next 63 or 64 years together. And that should be exciting and interesting rather than depressing to think about being with the person for the next 6 decades. In a study of long-term happy marriages, that maintaining the idealized view of the partner and of the relationship turns out to be one of the important characteristics. A summary of that study by Klagsgren is on the website for the course. You can look at what else she had listed there. That was from interviewing couples who were together long time and both of them quite happy with the relationship. And one of the things that's important is that they still think the other person is wonderful, but real. Okay. Now you're married. Now you've gotten all of those solved. Now you're pregnant. Okay? We just skipped over how you get there. Okay. Just believe. Just take it for granted. You're pregnant. And that brings us to Galinsky's book, The 6 Stages of Parenthood. And Galinsky, just to orient you, if you didn't recognize it, Galinsky, in interviewing parents, wide number of parents, wide variety of ages of the kids, attempted to find out what it is that parents have to wrestle with. And Wallerstein had interviewed couples to see what couples wrestle with. Galinsky's interviewing parents to see what they wrestle with and why. What is it that parents are trying to do, and what are they forced to do. So she comes up with a constructive view of parenting, because to her it seems very obvious that parents don't really know what they're getting into, the parents she interviewed at least. They're constructing their understanding and their skills as they parent. The early part, she describes, the stage of pregnancy, the first stage, she calls image building or image making. And in that, she says, the task that parents are engaged in is trying to create an image of what parenting is going to be like. They're constructing an image of what the child is going to be like. I think she's starting a little late in the process. It seems to me that many of you started building your image of what parenthood was going to be like when you were, how old? Okay. 12 or 14? When you're playing with your baby dolls, when you're a toddler, when you want that beautiful doll for Christmas or Hanukkah or birthday when you're 3, and you spend all that time nurturing it. From then on, you're creating an image of what parenting is going to be like, what babies are going to be like. And you're also creating that from your experience of being parented. Your parents are showing you how to do it, or for some of us, how not to do it. You're creating an image and ideally sharing that image with other people, ideally sharing it with your potential mate as part of the courtship process. But Galinsky starts with, here we are, we're married, now we're pregnant. We really have to start sharpening that image. And immediately, for many women, it becomes challenged because the image rarely includes morning sickness. The image rarely includes the changes in the couple relationship that are likely to happen during pregnancy, particularly if pregnancy is particularly uncomfortable. So that's one of the problems, is that you're starting to reshape that image already. One of the difficulties with the image is that nobody, until very recently, got as a child a crying doll that spit up. And even the ones that do spit up now don't spit up the way a baby really spits up. But people have tried to design dolls now that are much more realistic, and they have little genitals, and so you can practice being a parent of a boy or a girl. But they don't really poop. And they don't really poop the way real babies do. Yeah. Some of you know how, especially if the diaper's not on tight. Yeah. Especially if you've fed the kid strained spinach for the first time. Yeah. And it comes out both ends, and it's green, and it stains, especially on yellow shirts. And they don't make babies that projectile vomit. You know what projectile vomiting is? Exactly what it sounds like. Instead of just, it goes. Isn't it the distance record? It's probably somewhere around 7 feet. I've only observed 4 feet myself, and that was straight up in the air. That's a pretty impressive record. That typically goes along with a condition called pyloric stenosis, in which the valve at the base of the stomach into the intestine is overactive. And what it does is that valve normally controls the flow of things from the stomach into the intestine. But in some kids, it's overactive and it actually causes the entire stomach to contract quickly. And if the bottom of the stomach is contracting and the stomach is contracting, milk is only going to go one place, and that's out. And that usually is, it used to be, I'm not sure what the treatment is now, but it used to be surgically corrected by enlarging the valve there. So kids do all kinds of fascinating things that are not part of most of the images that we create when we're little. Most baby dolls are not shaped or proportioned or colored like newborns. Most baby dolls look like the Gerber baby, the one on the baby food box and the baby food jar and in all the ads. The Gerber baby is 6 or 8 months old. So they don't tell you what it's like to have a 6-pound little kid. Have any of you ever seen a doll for kids that was the size and shape and proportions, head shape of a newborn? You can get them, but they're very expensive. And most of us don't think about having dolls that are like that. Most of us, when we're playing as children, don't pretend that we have children with special needs. Most of us don't pretend that we have children with difficult temperaments. Most of us don't practice the skills of dealing with a baby who's uncooperative, nasty, terrible, and a spouse who's being uncooperative and stressful. Those are the images that people have to build in the process of parenting. So in Galinsky's book, what she's suggesting is that when babies come, the first thing that you can expect is that they're not what you expected. So being prepared for the unexpected is part of being ready to be a parent. What happens in the couple relationship as people get pregnant for the first time is that they have to start really getting serious about what this is going to do to their lives. And if neither of them has thought about that realistically, then they have some negotiating to do as a couple again. So what are you expecting? Let's get real about diapers. We have to make decisions. Are we going to have cloth diapers? Are we going to have disposables? That's the word I was looking for. Throwaway diapers. Are we going to have a separate bed for the child? Some of our friends, this is going to be the conversation, some of our friends have the baby sleep with them. Do we want to do that? Are we going to have a family bed? In many cultures, that's really not an item for discussion. You simply do. And everybody does. In our culture, for some reason, in Western culture, we decided that's not good. So American babies are abused by their parents, typically, by being placed in separate beds away from the parents. Abused in the eyes of other cultures who look at it and say, what? You don't like kids. You hate kids. Why did you have them? If you're not going to sleep with them and have them sleep with you, why would you put them someplace else? In some families, then, there's a discussion. I should provide a reference for some of what I just said. If you want to read more about babies, Small's book, Our Babies, Ourselves. Small is professor of anthropology at Cornell, and has written a very nice book looking at how other cultures deal with babies. And in it, she questions many of the bits of advice that she got as a new parent from books, from her pediatrician, and from her friends. And it's a very nice book because she really questions some of the things that in our macro system we take for granted. Well, of course, that's the way it is. But then she raises the question of why do so many other cultures do things so differently? What's the scientific evidence that would support different choices about how to deal with babies? And after you get through that and want to know what happens when kids get older, her second book on the topic is called Kids and deals with the early childhood and elementary years. Both available in paperback. She was here a couple of years ago. Did any of you hear her speak? No. Lots of fun. The couple is going to be figuring out what the macro system expects, what the authorities in the macro system expect, what advice you get from your pediatrician, what advice you get from various books, what do you get advice, what advice you get from Uncle Larry when you call him and say, how should we be dealing with our child, or Aunt Barbara, whoever. That advice is going to sharpen the image, and some of it is going to conflict with the image that you have. And much of it is going to give the couple a huge molar activity, very large challenge to figure out how they're going to incorporate a baby into their relationship, into their household, how they're going to change the setting, where they're going to put the baby, how they're going to change their daily routine, how they're going to accommodate having a baby, how they're going to deal with a baby while, as all their friends are telling them, they are suffering from chronic sleep deprivation and stress. That's not in the image that most of us create as we're thinking about being parents when we grow up. Galinsky's is clearly a transactional view. We're constructing our image from our experience, and as the experience begins to get more and more real, and arrival of a baby becomes more and more imminent, the decisions and reality come closer and closer, so we have to construct more and more understanding, and typically a couple is doing that together, and that may be a joint activity that brings them much closer together as they anticipate what they're going to be doing, as they make decisions that they agree on, as they nest and create a space for the baby, as they anticipate what this is going to be like. It brings them together because there's reciprocity and agreement in this molar activity. And of course, where some couples have that possibility, the opposite is always possible too. There may be increased opportunity for conflict. There may be increased attempts to make the decisions and keep the power. There may be conflict about how much reciprocity. There may be recognition that they have different views of the world. And often what happens for couples is that some of the gender differences in experience and image building come to the fore. And as the gender differences become obvious, what are they at first? One of the issues is that most young women in our culture spend much more time playing with dolls and practicing nurturing and thinking about what the experience is going to be like. I don't remember how I started that sentence, but you've got, that's what girls do, and that's not what boys do. Girls have had lots of opportunity to practice. They have taken care of infants and toddlers. They've done babysitting. They've been invited into the room when relatives and neighbors are nursing. The boys may have had much less real experience with babies. I watched about a year and a half ago now, I watched a scene that frustrated me greatly. And I'll just tell you about it, and then you can see whether it frustrates you. I am, as you know, a proponent of paternal involvement and reciprocity and equal involvement in parenting insofar as possible. And I don't think there's any evidence that men aren't interested in babies. My observations of little boys make it very clear that they're fascinated by babies. My conversations with teenage boys makes it very clear that they're fascinated by reproduction, not just doing it, but the whole process of reproduction, and they're fascinated by babies. So it doesn't come with the genes. It's not in the Y chromosome that boys aren't involved or interested. What happens is that they are often excluded, and they're often allowed to exclude themselves, in part because they don't know how to include themselves. The observation I made was in a family that had a niece visiting, and she had a 2.5-month-old baby. And there were several of her cousins and nieces and nephews around in the kitchen, and she was sitting in the chair. And systematically, the female cousins and nieces were being invited to hold the baby. And they were doing that, and they were getting lots of, "Oh, that's so cute," and actually one of the aunts was taking pictures, and just everybody wanted a picture taken with the baby. And there are three little boys in this group, and when they started to come in the kitchen, one of the aunts stopped them because they were being too noisy. One of the things that happens to boys. They were just coming in the kitchen. They were excited. Everybody in the kitchen was excited, so they wanted to partake in this. And one of them came over, and you could just see. He was about 5. He was looking at this baby. He was hungry for some kind of involvement and engagement with this baby. And nobody picked up on it. They just... You know, the girls had been invited to hold the baby, so here's him, next in line. Nobody responded. And he finally, somebody got out some food, so he was distracted to cookies or cake or something. And a few minutes later, another cousin came in, was about 8, male, and one of the aunts, playfully, not seriously, you could tell by her tone of voice, said, "Oh, come and hold the baby." And my take on his facial expression was, "Wow, okay." And he was hesitant. And he said, "Oh, I, and he started to say something that was kind of negative, and she let him get away with it. "That's all right, maybe later." And he was gone. Just because he was hesitant, she picked it up as he didn't want to do it. But clearly from his facial expression, he really wanted to do it. So what I had seen in the course of a few minutes was why little boys think they're not supposed to be interested in babies, because other people aren't interested in them being interested in babies, so they bail out. And then the other piece that becomes very important is that when they try to play doll and family in the preschool or in kindergarten, the little boys feed off each other to be child abusers, or they're sent off to work rather than encouraged to practice baby play. And how many of you guys spent much time in high school babysitting? Okay. Some of us do, and that's why we're in, of course, on family, right? Yes, because some of us do. But many couples will not hire a teenage boy to take care of babies. They will hire a teenage boy to be a companion for 6 or 8-year-old boys. But to take care of a young infant, it's very difficult to get experience as a male in our culture. So, with all of that, boys have much less experience, typically. So now they're married. Now they're going to have a baby, and she's the expert, and he's not. In fact, he knows very little. So, in order to learn from her, he has to decide it's okay for me not to know anything. It's okay for me to ask questions. It's okay for me to say I don't know. And her response to that is supposed to be, I will teach you everything you need to know. I know you can learn. I know you've not had experience. And it's really important to me that you will be engaged fully and competently and comfortably as a parent. That's a supportive response that says, I'll help you overcome the shortcomings of your childhood. Now think about the couples you know and whether that's the response when he doesn't know what he's doing about babies. What happens, unfortunately, often when the baby arrives, we'll jump to that, is that he tries, and he really wants to learn to do this, and he doesn't do it as smoothly or as comfortably as she does. So what does she do? He's not getting the diaper on quite right. It's taking him a long time. He's not practiced this before. He doesn't know which way the t-shirt goes on or whatever else he's trying to do. And instead of coaching, making sure that he learns this and is comfortable, she takes over. Many men report that they become less involved in daily caretaking of infants, their own infants, than they expected to, because that's what their wives wanted. Their wives wouldn't let them do it. And if you talk to women about why their husbands aren't so involved, you get a somewhat different story. He didn't want to. He wasn't good at it. And he is allowed to get away with not learning basic human skills rather than being encouraged to learn them. The best way for him to learn them is for her to show them and support him, and for her to support him in learning them and praise every little step that he takes, and to let him learn some things the hard way. One of the classic examples is he puts the diaper on. She knows it's not quite tight enough. So when he finishes, she takes over and readjusts it. And the silent message is, you're an idiot. And the silent message he receives is, I don't do this very well. I'm not good at it. What she ought to do, any of you know what she ought to do? When he moves around, it's going to stretch, so you might want to just tighten up the left leg a little bit. That kind of response. I think even better from my, well, you know me, so. My approach would be, make sure that he holds the baby for the next 3 hours. He'll learn. Right. Well, he should be doing that. Right. Okay. But the reason you want him to hold the baby for the next 3 hours is that if it's not tight enough, he will discover that. And most of us learn in one trial. You know, all it takes is a lap full of crap, and you're going to learn. You're going to know. And next time, you're going to have to watch to make sure that the legs aren't turning blue, because that diaper is going to be cutting off the kid's circulation. But think about the joint activity that this couple is going into when one of them has a lot more expertise than the other. And then think about what the goal is. Is the goal to become equally competent? In which case you might have to coach the other person. If you are going to be playing bridge with this other person for the next 30 or 40 years, as a partner in bridge, would you want that person to be incompetent, or would you help that person learn to be better? So parenting is very much like, potentially very much like playing bridge as partners. You want your partner to be as competent as possible. but you have to be relatively equal in playing bridge as partners because it's a two, you're in it together, and parenting is the same way. General proposition from Galinsky. We go from one stage to the other because the baby comes. And generally because children push us into the next stage. Going from the image-making stage to the nurturing stage is usually very abrupt. Here it is. There's the baby. These are both on page 48. Just write down 48 and you can grab them. I'll put them up on the web. The nurturing stage. This is the stage of infancy into toddlerhood. Parents have to figure out how to nurture a child who is not usually what they expected. It's not the Gerber baby. It doesn't sleep when they sleep. It spits up every day for the first year, several times. It poops on a completely irregular schedule. It screams when it's unhappy. It stinks. It has cradle cap. It has diaper rash. You know, it's just none of those things that people expected. It cries if you put it down. And you have to figure out how to love it anyway. How to nurture it. How to take care of its ills. That is the wrong quote for that stage. That is the quote that begins the third stage, the interpretive stage. I was sitting here trying to figure out why does that look so familiar and why does it look so out of place? Forget that. We are in the nurturing stage. Very interesting. Where did that one come from? Okay, here we go. I like this one much better. Now you have to go through, relabel that one that you were copying down. Okay, the major task of this stage is to form an attachment with this baby. And you've got to figure out how this baby is real and the one you were imagining is a fantasy that you have to drop. And the fantasy that you have is not going to be satisfied by having a second child because the second one is going to be real too. And for Galinsky, having to enlarge the relationship with each other. That's what Wallerstein meant when she says expanding the relation to make psychological room for children and safeguarding the private sphere of the couple. The relationships that you have with your own parents change, particularly if this is the first grandchild. And you have to figure out how to keep the advice other people are giving you and the support they're offering, how to keep that in perspective while you construct your own comfortable way of parenting. So for both mothers and fathers, there is a challenge. First, to form an attachment with the child and figure out how to be a nurturing person. Which one of you is going to get up in the middle of the night and walk this child around? Which one of you, if you have a colicky child, is going to take the kid for a drive in the car seat? The car seat, the kid's in the car seat, the car seat's in the car. You got that. And you're going to drive around for an hour because that's the only place the kid will sleep. Kid goes to sleep when you put her in the car seat. 3 o'clock in the morning, you're out on the town. driving. Just one of you, not both of you. The other one gets to stay home and sleep. How do you negotiate that? How do you figure out what the skills are that you need to help this baby stay safe and healthy and eventually learn to be an acceptable human being? That's the nurturing stage task. And it's a task for both parents. Usually at this point, I subtitle the next section of the lecture, "Okay, you've had a baby. What have you done? You have ruined a perfectly good relationship." And it's the easiest way to ruin a marriage. Easiest way to ruin a relationship is to have a baby. Remember Bronfenbrenner. Here you are, husband, wife, one dyad, positive affect, reciprocity, equal balance of power, fun and excitement and good sex and all of those other things, and then all you did was add 6 or 8 pounds of baby. That's all you did. But you tripled the number of dyads in the family. So your family is now 3 times as complex. Interesting. 50% more people. 3 times as many dyads. Each dyad is a complex, changing relationship that now has to find its own reciprocity, its own affect, its own balance of power. And 2 of them are new. And 2 of those dyads are brand new. There's no experience with this person. And both people are trying to create, both parents are trying to create a relationship with this child. So they have to figure out what the motor activities are. They have to create positive affect, ideally. They have to eventually figure out who's got the power, and we know it's the kid. And they are doing that simultaneously. And Wallace Dean's comment, preserving the private sphere of the couple means maintaining the pre-existing dyad of the couple, which is now going to change dramatically. How to have fun again, how to maintain your interest in each other, your respect for each other, how to engage in these 2 new relationships in a way that is not competitive. There's only one person here to have those relationships with, and each of them is trying to do it, so there's potential for competition. Bronfenbrenner's hypothesis number, whatever it was, suggests that the ability of each of these parents to create a developmental dyad with the baby depends on the existence of the other dyads. So the ability for daddy and baby to create a good relationship depends in part on mother's relationship with the baby and whether she's willing to share. And it depends on how the husband and wife are getting along with each other, whether the baby becomes a focus for conflicts between them, which may not be about the baby at all. Life becomes complex. This baby brings into the microsystem a complex set of challenging motor activities that have to be mastered. They have to be fit into a microsystem pattern, and that's not easy because many of those activities require time and energy, and some of them require finances. Some of them require connections to the mesosystem that get complex. You can get yourself to the dentist, you can get your spouse to the doctor, now you've got to get the baby to the emergency room, to the pediatrician, to wherever else it's going to have connections in the mesosystem. So life has become much more complex. and again is with chronic sleep deprivation for most couples for at least several months. What else has happened? Oh yeah, roles have changed. Baby's a new role in the family. Each of the parents has a new role. A role they haven't played before, if we're talking about a first marriage, first kid. They haven't played that. They played at it, perhaps. But now it becomes a real role. And it's a role in relationship to the baby who has or will develop expectations for them. But it is also a role that's transactional with the role of the other parent. The way you father depends on how your partner is mothering and what she expects of you as a father. But what you've worked out as husband and wife has to be renegotiated as you work out what it means to be father and mother, and then you've got to put those into the real package that you are both only one person. Each of you is only one person. So you have to figure out how to be husband and father simultaneously while the other person becomes wife and mother simultaneously. And those roles may or may not conflict with each other. Husband, we'll talk about traditional stereotypic families. Okay? Mother quit work temporarily because that's what she wanted to do and he approved. Therefore, there's an income decrease while there's an expense increase. Okay. There are now three mouths to feed and one of them doesn't eat hamburger. At the beginning, it may be fairly simple and cheap, but there are many other expenses that come along with babies. Some of you have been told repeatedly by your parents that you're worth every bit of the $100,000 they spent to raise you to the point where you are now, not counting UVM tuition. Right? $100,000 to raise the... Oh, gee, a nitly. Well, that's not much. It's only $5,000 a year. So, no problem. So reducing it to one salary and needing more income means that husbands are supposed to bring home the bacon. They're actually supposed to bring home a paycheck. And they're supposed to get the groceries and work more because she's working less. On the other hand, the father role means that he's supposed to be playing with the baby, holding the baby, taking care of the baby, letting mom go to yoga, so she can maintain her sanity. And he has to figure out how to work more and make more income while he's home more, engaged in more childcare activities. So the roles may be incompatible. And it really is 22, and we'll go on from there.
Just this, what we had to say from each other.